Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show. Before we begin, let's hear a quick message from our sponsor.
Hello, HR. It's me, your HR data. And I need to apologize. I'm sorry for being all over the place. I'm sorry for being difficult. I'm sorry for not being there for you. But it's not my fault. You put me in different HR systems and messy spreadsheets. But guess what? I now have a new friend, and their name is Employee Cycle. They can put all of me in one HR dashboard for you and keep me updated and simple so we'll better understand each other. Look, we're smarter when we're working together, so if you want me to show you my full potential, please go to employeecycle.com to get your free demo today. That's employeecycle.com. Promise me you'll go. Our relationship depends on it.
Welcome back, folks, to the Employee Cycle Podcast. I'm your host for today, Bruce Marable, and I am thrilled to announce our special guest today because they actually do not come from the HR world, but they sure have a lot to say about how the workplace should be handled today. This woman is an influential and sought-after media presence, having built an organic following of over 100,000 followers worldwide. She is always all over the media, and people are constantly asking her for her advice. She's a digital media consultant, and she also is the creator of the hashtag OscarSoWhite. Please give it up for our special guest, April Rain. Thank you. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be on.
Yay! I don't know if you knew, but... Oh, yeah, but I am so excited, and we always like to give a huge round of applause because we know you could be doing a million other things. So today we are going to talk about, is the workplace fair? A lot of people are always asking this, but before we get into the topic, can you please give us a background or some background and context and info around who you are? How did you become a digital media consultant? How did you get on the map? And how are you currently tackling issues around diversity and inclusion?
Oh my goodness, that's so much. Okay. So I practiced law for 20 years and decided that it was not feeding me creatively. It did not speak to my passion at all. So while I was still practicing, I reached out to a friend, Drew Shade, who is the editorial director and founder of Broadway Black, which is a digital media platform that focuses and highlights on the successes and achievements of African Americans, both on and off the Broadway stage. And I became a writer for him initially, just because I needed something that would feed my creative outlet. And then once I did, I realized how much he was taking on his own, and I took on more responsibility and became managing editor. So I was doing that, and that was great. And then in January of 2015, I created the hashtag OscarSoWhite about the lack of diverse and inclusive nominees for that particular year, with respect to categories both in front of and behind the camera. And that became my mainstay, really. And so I took a leap of faith and left my very cushy and comfortable and well-paying job, and became sort of this digital media consultant, where I was consulting on issues regarding diversity and inclusion for networks, for studios, for corporations, for organizations, and I still do that work. And just really having discussions, as you mentioned, you know, in various forms of media about the lack of inclusion in entertainment. And I use the words diversity and inclusion hand in hand, but they really are different, right? So, for example, we can say that the Trump administration is diverse because it has Ben Carson and Omarosa and a few others, right, that we can name.
Right.
But I wouldn't call the Trump administration inclusive, because those two people and no one else, from what it seems, actually have a seat at the table who are listened to when decisions are being made. And that's the distinction. It's not enough just to have, you know, a fly in the buttermilk. You must have someone who has decision-making power when it comes to these very important choices that need to be made. So for the past 2.5 years now, since January of 2015, I've been discussing issues of diversity and inclusion. And just about 6 weeks ago now, I was on Twitter. I'm sure we're going to get into this, on social media. And I had created a hashtag called Women of Color Affirmation, WOC Affirmation was the hashtag. And long story short, it was to uplift and affirm women of color wherever they may be in life. You know, if you were able to get up this morning and get your kid on the bus and now you're relaxing at home, you know, let's affirm who you are. You know, you don't have to be an executive or a lawyer or what have you. You know, we just need to affirm each other, and we also need to affirm ourselves, because I don't think that we do that enough. I think that again, we'll talk about this in the workplace. I think that white men, you know, every time they make a decision whether they're going to drink the regular Coke or a Diet Coke, you know, they get praised, they take a day off or something. And, you know, women of color especially, you know, can hold the entire company on their back sometimes for very little affirmation. So I created a hashtag. Someone said, you know what, you're some kind of hashtag genie or goddess or something. You know, this one was trending internationally as well, the same way that Oscar So White and a few others that I've created have done. They said, you know, somebody really should be paying you for this. And I said, you know what, somebody should be paying me to lift up their brand or their hashtag in the way that I've learned how to do in the last couple of years. And in response to that one tweet, someone reached out to me and said, we would love to work with you. And that was it. There was no resume. There was a short interview over tea just to find out what my interests were. And then I came on board. So, you know, you can say that it's just Twitter, as people like to say, but I literally have gotten several jobs from social media, and that is one. And that particular job is now being the national spokesperson for the Keep Birth Control Copay Free campaign. And it's a fantastic consulting job that I absolutely love. And it came due to social media.
Wow. That was amazing and really impressive. So let's get into it, because I'm sure you have a lot to say about this. Is the workplace fair? And
no.
I know that's a big question, and that was a very quick answer. But is it fair anywhere? And is it more fair in certain places than others? And I'm asking that question broadly, intentionally. But is it more fair for females or women in certain industries? Is it more fair for people of color in others? Have you seen that? Do you think it's just as bad across the board? Let's really get into that. And then wherever that takes us, that's where we'll go.
Okay. I don't think it's industry specific. I think, again, it's the decision makers who decide whether the workplace is fair, right? So overall, I can say the entertainment industry is not fair to women or people of color or any marginalized community, right? But then I can pick out specific organizations like Macro Films, for example, or the work that Ava DuVernay does, and say, yes, within that unfair industry, there are pockets, because the decision makers are people from traditionally underrepresented communities in that industry, and they are seeing to it that at least with respect to their sphere of influence, they are making it fair. So that's why it matters not what industry you're in, but who is leading that particular organization or corporation of which you want to be a part. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I want to get into that a little bit more. So you said the decision makers. From what you've seen and the companies that you've been exposed to through your work in D&I, do you think it really is from the top down, or can there be certain champions inside of an organization that might not necessarily be the CEO or the C-suite, but could be someone like an HR person, or maybe even someone who creates some type of diversity organization or diversity initiative in an organization? Can that change really happen from the bottom up, or do you think it really has to happen from the top down with the ultimate decision makers?
It's an interesting question. I think that some change can happen even when you're not in the C-suite. But I think that the corporate culture is defined by those at the top. And so it is them that need to make sure that they are dialed in and have fully bought into issues of diversity and inclusion, right? Because the HR person can get you in there. The vice president, let's say, you know, and so many, I can tell you from my work, so many corporations and organizations now have specific folks, you know, instilled vice president of diversity inclusion or something to that effect, right? But they still only have so much power. And so it's fantastic if you can find one of those people, and they don't necessarily have to be of the same, you know, demographic makeup that you are. So what, you know, if you're a Black woman, it may in fact be a white man who is championing you within the organization. That's absolutely fine. I call those people ambassadors. Okay. Not just mentors, because a mentor can be maybe outside of that particular organization. You know, somebody, you know, it might be an old college professor or something. And it's someone that you go to and say, hey, you know, I have a question about this. I'm struggling here. What do you suggest? That, and that's fantastic. And everybody should have one of those. That would be, you know, one of my big advice, one of my tips for everybody. Get a mentor. But the ambassador is someone who works within the organization to move you where you want to be, you know, and whatever that means. Usually it means up, but sometimes it may be out, right? However you want to see yourself in the company, the ambassador is your champion. And so it's important to find that person. But even still, unless the ambassador is the CEO or the president, however your organization is built, that person can only take you so far. And so, you know, if the ambassador says, hey, April is the absolute best person for the job, but the CEO wants to put in his nephew, then I'm out, you know, then I'm out of a promotion, right? And so that's why I think that it's important to have those people within the organization, but with respect to structural change, systemic change, actual commitment, you know, because that's another thing. Diversity and inclusion are big words right now. Everybody's using them, everybody's talking about them, and that's fine. But I have had situations where it became very clear to me as I'm walking into the organization that they are just trying to check a box off saying that they had diversity and inclusion training, but they are not committed, you know. And so that's why in my rider, I ensure that I come back 6 months from now and see what you've done, you know. And it's like the Spike Lee, do the right thing. How come there still ain't no brothers up on the wall? And I've, you know, and I've been gone 6 months. You know, what do you actually do to take my suggestions and advice and put them into practice?
Interesting. So, with so many different things happening in the workplace and in the world, so we can talk about it on both sides, where it's microaggressions, racism, all types of bias against sexual orientation, sexual harassment, lack of people of color in management and executive positions. I mean, there's so many things. And I'm not making excuses, but I've heard on our podcast, and also just from reading blogs and just understanding where a lot of people are there in a minority who are typically white, that there's so many different things happening at the same time. How do you fix everything? Mm-hmm. So for those who want to give that, I'm going to call it an excuse, where do you start? And how do you give someone a framework? And we're big on frameworks on our podcast because we never just want to leave somebody with just a conversation. We want to say, you know what? Yeah, I could take that back into my workplace after I listen to this and execute and implement. So where do you start? How do you start figuring out which of these issues to focus on first? Do you see, well, we've had a lot of sexual harassment cases, so because that's the pressing issue today, that's where your company starts? Or what if nothing has happened, at least from an HR compliance lawsuit standpoint, but you know that all these issues exist, where do you start?
Yeah, it has to be a both and approach. You know, you have to tackle all of it. And I will also say, you know, depending on who is listening to the podcast right now, it may not be your responsibility, right? So if you are just an employee, you know, or a person, you know, who is on the initial tier, you have to protect your neck, as they say. Yeah, you're going to get a lot of hip-hop references and movie references from me. You know, but you have to be careful that you don't overextend yourself, especially without an ambassador, once again, you know, and leave yourself hanging out there, right? So, for example, what we often say is it is not the responsibility of people of color to solve racism in America. Right? Because we already know it exists and we're not the ones perpetrating it against others. It is the responsibility of white folks to wake up and realize that there are issues and fight to make systemic and structural change. Similarly, it is not the responsibility of women to fix sexual harassment in the workplace, right? And that is the responsibility of the men who are very often the harassers. Not to say that women don't, because we know that they do, but overall, and in your particular organization or company, it is probably true that the majority of the harassers are men. That can't be, you can't put a woman on the line and say, hey, you've got to stop harassing, you know, and you do the same thing within your family as well, right? It's not the person who has been put upon. I don't like to use the word victim, but the person who has been aggrieved, it is not their responsibility to fix your shortcomings. So how do you approach this? You know, it is easy to use things that are in the culture, in the news, in pop culture to sort of very gently suggest. So if I am in just an employee working, you know, I could, and I am aware of, issues of sexual harassment in my office place. I may say to my supervisor, hey, you know, there's been a lot in the news about Harvey Weinstein and all kinds of other folks. You know, harassing and abusing women. It might be a great look for the company for us to have our own sexual harassment training to make sure that the company is not, you know, liable. Okay, so do you see what I did there? A, I'm not taking credit for the idea, yep. Right? I'm giving it to my supervisor so the supervisor can run it up the chain. I'm not saying that I am aware of anything going on in the company, so I'm not accusing anybody. I'm just giving a good idea. I'm putting, you know, a bug in the ear of the employer, and then the employer can take it, you know, your supervisor can take it up the line, and maybe it starts at the department level. Maybe it's just your particular department having a sexual harassment training day or what have you, and then maybe it spreads to other departments because that first one went so well. That's how you handle, you know, all of the different issues. And then maybe, you know, and then talk to your coworkers, you know, and you can do a divide and conquer kind of thing, you know, so it shouldn't be one very woke employee trying to get, you know, all of the issues that are going on in the company solved. But maybe I can sit down with my girl Linda over lunch and say, hey, you know that there's a whole bunch of, you know, not a whole bunch, but you know that there's racism, discrimination or so on going on. There's also some sexual harassment stuff going on. How about I suggest something on sexual harassment. You suggest something on, you know, tolerance and diversity and inclusion. And then maybe with this divide and conquer strategy, we can get a couple of things going at the same time. Again, that's the employee taking on stuff that they shouldn't be, because it should be the supervisor, it should be the CEO, really, you know, suggesting and commanding that those things happen. But that's an easy way to sort of try and get the ball rolling on several different issues at once.
So most of the people who are listening to our podcast are HR professionals. And typically,
I wanted to say that
most of the, but I so appreciate your answer, but most of the people who are listening to our podcast are HR professionals, and 9.9 times out of 10, they're either responsible for all of the things that we're talking about now, or, mm-hmm. or at least people will default to them for being responsible. So does your answer change at all? Now that we're talking to HR professionals, or do you think that they should already be fighting the fight tooth and nail to make sure that all of this is handled? And if so, how?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I mean, if you are an HR professional, then you know it is your responsibility to make your workplace as diverse and inclusive as possible, because the research shows that a more diverse and inclusive and welcoming environment is good for business. Bottom line, money talks, right? And so my answer doesn't change. It just means that hopefully there are less people, you know, less hoops that you have to jump yep. through to get this stuff done, right? So because you're an HR professional, you can say, hey, we are going to have diversity training, right? Or we are going to have training on sexual harassment in the workplace. And then bring in somebody. Don't use the films and the stuff from the 70s or whatever to try and explain what's going on today. I've seen it. So bring in folks who have been relatively recently trained in best practices. You know, they don't have to be new to the genre, you know, with respect to this type of training, but at least you know that their information is current. And so, you know, I think it's all in packaging and positioning. So if you are the HR, the head of HR, you can say, you know, we don't want, you know, Harvey Weinstein has cost his organization millions of dollars. We don't want that happening here. You know, and you also know what types of the complaints that you are getting. So, you know what it looks like, you know, whether people are harassing, whether people are being intolerant and so on. And so you know better where to focus. But, you know, again, say we don't want a Harvey Weinstein situation happening in ABC Corporation. So let's get in front of this. From a financial perspective, it makes more sense to pay for 2 days of training on this particular issue and bring somebody in than to pay potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars in a lawsuit down the line. Again, you relate it back to the bottom line of the company, how you're saving the company money up front, and I'm hoping that you will get, you know, very little pushback because people understand dollars and cents.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Because a lot of money and time and effort goes into creating these reports saying that if you have a more diverse workforce, that you'll have more engagement, better ideas, more innovation. I'm in the tech space, so there are constantly reports being published saying that if you have at least one female co-founder, the company will be better and it's more likely to be successful. But for most of the people who are running these organizations, I personally don't think that a research paper, a study, a report is going to change the minds of any of these individuals. And we've clearly seen that because the diversity numbers in some industries have moved by a decimal point, and in others, they haven't moved at all. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the other industries, they've even gone backwards. So we clearly know that that's not mm-hmm. working. And we keep saying dollars and cents, doesn't that make sense? I mean, it's in your best interest to have a more diverse workforce, and that's still not working. So if you can't get through to people through money, and unless something happens and then people are protesting the business, so then from a media standpoint, they have to start hiring all different types of people, what do we do?
I don't know that I have the answer. I think you have to find whatever that sweet spot is for the person, for the decision maker, because all you're saying is that you want to have more training, right? At least initially. And then you want to hire more folks and more diverse folks. So you have to find the sweet spot for the decision maker for those type of changes that you seek. So is it empathy? You know, is it guilt? Is it, you know, is it money, bottom line? You figure out what that thing is. And again, even as an HR representative, having an ambassador to help to champion your cause is going to be helpful, right? Because voices are loudest when they rise together. So if you can find, if you are the HR head and you can find the VP of whatever who understands what you're saying and who will go with you and say, yes, I agree, this also needs to happen, you know, there's strength in numbers. And so, again, use that ambassador to help you move that cause along. I mean, it's not easy. You know, the HR head can't go into the CEO or CFO or whomever and say, you know, you need to hire more people from underrepresented communities, and they're just going to say, oh, okay,
right,
cool.
Right.
and
oh,
you know,
that sounds like a great idea. Let's do it.
But the HR rep also has, you know, it may be one of the first people to see the resumes as they come in, right? And so maybe you can help steer the process along that way, in ensuring that at least folks from diverse backgrounds get an interview. And you know, and I'm sure we're going to segue into this at some point, because that's part of the opportunity that's necessary. Never a quota system. I'm definitely not advocating that. But I'm saying, if you can say that you see two people who are basically identical on paper with their resumes, and one you believe to be from a traditionally underrepresented community and the other you believe not, make sure that that person from the traditionally underrepresented community gets an interview and is allowed to prove themselves. Right. So they don't necessarily get the job, but at least they get a shot to prove what they can do.
So from your experience working as a consultant in the D&I space, I'm assuming that maybe not all of the point of contacts you've been working with, but at least some of them have been HR professionals, correct? So from your experience as our first non-HR practitioner guest, what is your perception of the HR role in this safe space? What is your perception?
Yeah, no, I think it's crucial. I think that you're the conductor of the train. You know, I mean, so the decisions that the HR professional makes are incredibly underrated and undervalued, I think. I don't think that people understand the power that HR reps have to hire, to fire, to, you know what I'm saying, to get people in the door. And so with that responsibility, you know, comes challenges, but also opportunities to attempt to make your workplace as inclusive as possible, because you do understand that the research matters. And, you know, there's not just one study, there's multiple studies that say, you know, as you said, a more welcoming workspace is going to be a more profitable workspace. So, you know, I think people think, you know, that all HR reps are, you know, these overweight black women named Betty who you can go to, you know what I mean, to because your check was mailed instead of direct deposited or something like that. When, you know, these people, HR reps are incredibly well-trained, you know, have the best interest of the company at heart, and have the ability to change what the workplace looks like. And I think that's way too often discounted.
From the group of HR professionals that you've worked with, and just from those that you've encountered and met or spoke with in any capacity, do you feel that most HR people or HR professionals are afraid of trying to create this type of change? And if so, why? Do you think that even in their role, they could be seen as a person who's just trying to do too much and potentially lose their job, or are too afraid because they think it's such an uphill battle that they may be seen as focusing on the wrong things versus just staying in their lane? Could you give some context around that?
I think that it's a lack of support, that the infrastructure isn't built up so that the HR professional is given the support that they need, and the power that they have to wield to make these systemic changes happen. And so they're in a very difficult spot. And again, you know, if you don't have an ambassador, if you don't have somebody working with you, it can be very hard to put yourself out there. And I think that they, you know, they are discounted way too often, so that even if you say, hey, this is what we need to do, you know, it's very often, oh, well, she or he is just the HR person. They don't really understand how the company works, or, you know, how the bottom line is set up, or what have you. And I think that that's unfair. So, you know, I think it's a lack of, it's a misperception about who HR professionals are, and the power that they hold. And the fact that they are very often, you know, the folks who are most up to date with respect to what's going on in that particular industry, you know, not the competitors, right? So that's the CEO, CFO, COO's job, the C-suite job. But what's going on with respect to the industry and how things are changing, and hopefully the HR professional is the person that's staying on top of that.
Great. So our topic is all around, is the workplace fair? So let's talk about some of the areas where the workplace is not fair. Obviously, in the recruiting space, there's a lot of unconscious bias when it comes to upward mobility and moving up along the ranks. There's a lot of bias. But I would like for you to talk about areas that you've seen yourself as, you know, as a working professional, but then also as a D&I consultant, where you've seen the most bias, or you've seen, which areas have you seen where it's the most unfair in the workplace?
Yeah, I mean, I think the vast majority, I would say, is in recruiting, because recruiting and retention to me go hand in hand. So you can bring in the best possible employees, but if they're staying for less than a year, you know, or less than two, because the workplace is uninviting, is unwelcoming, is, you know, discriminatory, you know, sort of a, you know, a sliding scale of, you know, what is going to be your trigger, your breaking point, then you have to make sure that once you bring the folks in that you can actually keep them there. And that goes to workplace culture. So, you know, when we speak of implicit bias, I am a big proponent of blind resumes, you know, so you don't have the person's name, you know, at the top, and you're making the decision. And, you know, again, there have been studies done on this. If you change, you know, Jamal Winston's name to John Winston, there's a significant increase in the potential that John is going to get the interview, where Jamal would not, right? So I'm a big proponent of just allowing folks to get in the door and proving themselves to you, you know, because if you think about it, once we've had folks like Oprah and Condoleezza and Barack, you know, attain the heights that they have with the names that they have, clearly the name should not put you off with respect to whether the person can do the work, right? So there's a lot of bias, both implicit and not, and explicit, at the recruiting stage. You know, and then once you get into the company or the organization, then you're thinking about retention. And that means, you know, what does your board look like? You know, does it look like, you know, the incoming GOP freshman class, right? Does it, you know, does what, you know, what do, who are the decision makers? You know, and is the only black or brown person in the room taking notes? You know, and then once you go below the C-suite, what do, you know, the managers look like? What kind of training have they had? What are their experiences? So, I think it runs the gamut throughout the corporation. You know, when I do consulting, you know, of course I get the, you know, the business models and, you know, and the trees. And so I know, you know, who is where in the company. And you very often have to go pretty far down in the tree of the company to find not only people of color, but also women, you know. So I talk about the issue simultaneously, because having a woman, you know, in a decision-making position also matters, in addition to having folks of color up there, and people from marginalized communities, you know. And let's also talk about disabled folks and why they are, you know, rising to the top. Let's talk about folks who are openly of, you know, various sexual orientations. You know, let's talk about what process you have in place when a employee comes to you, hello, HR professional, and says that she is in transition and she is transitioning from male to female. And so we need to change the names. I've experienced this where, you know, you had to go through legal to change someone's name from, you know, Jonathan to Sarah, You know, and so when you're on Slack or whatever internal email system you're using, how long is it going to take you to recognize that Sarah's name should be on the email list not Jonathan's anymore? Right. You know, and so these are things that the HR professional is going to have to do, because now it's offensive to Sarah, you know, when her name still says, you know, they're, you know, the company is still using her dead name, as they say, you know, weeks after she has told you that she's, you know, making this change, you know, and so it's harmful to her, you know, and what kind of message, literal message, like email or what have you, are you sending out to the company to let folks know Sarah's name is no longer Jonathan, and so you need to refer to her as Sarah, right? So that is becoming one of the really big issues now, as more people are openly transitioning, and they need support of the organization to which they may have given a decade of their life.
Wow. So with your lawyer hat on, you know, I only thought about this from what you just said in regards to changing the names during the transition. Do you think HR needs to work closer with legal now, or need to start understanding the legal ramifications of all these things that they didn't have to understand before? Because this seems to be uncharted territory that HR now has to manage. How does a person even start going about all of these things if they aren't even aware of them in the world, let alone in their company?
Yeah, well, it's the HR professional's responsibility to be aware of these things. And I would hope that the HR department and legal are already working closely together, because there are other issues. So the sexual orientation issue is one, but if we just talk about sexual harassment, you know, so how are we defining harassment in the workplace? What does that mean? What are the ramifications going to be if a female employee comes to me and says, you know, every time Chris comes into my office, he's sitting on the corner of my desk and he's fondling my arm or what have you, and it makes me uncomfortable. What are you doing? You know, what is the first step? You know, where is it, you know, you have the conversation with them and then you write them up and then, you know, and then there's a verbal warning and, you know, and then there's a written warning. You know what I mean? How are you escalating? So those should already be things that legal and human resources should be talking about hand in hand. With respect to these relatively newer issues, you know, they're happening. And so, you know, again, it's your responsibility. I'm hoping that your organization or company is being flexible and amenable to you going to, you know, trainings and seminars and conferences and workshops where these discussions are being had, because they are out there, so that you are making sure that you're keeping up with best practices for a changing workplace. You know, what a workplace, you know, the differences, you know, because it's not just the sexual orientation thing. You know, we've seen on a smaller scale, you know, Black women who have been fired or put on leave because their hair was unkempt, and I'm using my air quotes there, you know, because they had dreadlocks or they had braids or what have you. You know, the Army went through a big thing where, you know, now they're allowing braids, right? So, I mean,
welcome to 2017.
So that's happening. Right. So if that's happening in the Army, you know that that's going to happen, you know, in a non-military space as well. So you need to be prepared for that. What does your dress code look like? When's the last time that it has been updated? You know, what does Casual Friday look like? Because these are all things that at some point you need to run by legal to make sure that you are not being overly restrictive, but that you are also protecting those who may be aggrieved, and so that you know exactly what to do when something happens. You know, if somebody comes to you and says, you know, hey, I'm going through transition, or hey, you know, so-and-so is harassing me, or hey, you know, I've been passed over 3 times and I was the most qualified for this person for this position and I'm Black, you know, you should know what to do for all of those different situations. And obviously, you know, everyone is going to be unique. And so the answer may be, you know, I'll get back to you in 24 hours, but you need to know that you've got somebody in legal, somebody that you can rely on so that you don't have to take more than 24 hours to get a response to that aggrieved person.
For a long time now, HR has been trying to get away from just being the overbearing, overwatcher, rules maker, paper pusher role to roles around entitled People Operations and Getting into Data and Being More Strategic and Being a Business Partner. So from an HR standpoint, how do you make sure that you still have a fun, engaging, inviting, open and transparent culture and environment, but at the same time, making sure that, like you said, people are addressing individuals by the right pronoun or casual Fridays or doing all these other things that seems to be putting them back into a place where there's so many rules. And I'll say this. So the other day, I forget what I was listening to, but some radio segment, there were people calling in and they were talking about what they believe they can and cannot say in the workplace anymore. And then there were guys calling in saying that they're afraid now to even comment on a woman's dress because they think that they'll be guilty of sexual harassment and lose their job. So how does HR deal with all that?
Yeah, very carefully. You know, the guy's calling in about, I get exasperated sometimes because it's like, you know, you're not the aggrieved person here. So, you know, making yourself out to be a victim because you don't know whether you can slap Sally on the behind anymore, you know, isn't really an issue. You know what I mean?
Right.
Isn't an issue. I mean, for me, it's very often it can be solved with, if Sally was a man, would you have commented on, Richard's new suit? Hey, Richard, that's a good looking suit there. You know,
right.
That new whatever.
Right.
So if you would have said that, then it's probably okay for you to say, hey, Sally, is that a new dress? That's nice. You know, I like that color or whatever. Right. As opposed to, oh my goodness, you know, that fits you well. You know, because you wouldn't say
right.
that. You know, you wouldn't say that to Richard. So if you can, and that goes for gender. That also goes for, you know, race. If you would not comment on Lauren's new hairstyle, then when Shamika comes in and her hair is 18 inches when it was just 4 inches yesterday, then that's probably something you shouldn't comment on either, right? So if you just flip the script a little bit, many folks know how to behave properly. They just want to act as if they are victims and, oh, I can't understand and the workplace is becoming too hard for me and, you know, let's just go back to where it was all men, basically. You know, all white men is where they're going with that, right? So for the HR professional, I mean, you know, again, this is why I say that they're underrated, undervalued, because it is hard to sort of implement all of the rules and still keep the workplace inviting and fun. But I think part of it is, when you have the diversity trainings or inclusion trainings or sexual harassment trainings or whatever, that you make those fun to the extent that you can, because it's a very serious issue. But that's, again, why you're bringing somebody in. So it's not necessarily the HR rep. And this is a little bit of passing the buck, as I was speaking about earlier, which is absolutely fine. So it's not the HR rep standing in front of a group of 50 or whatever, you know, sort of giving you the rules and forcing you to read the manual. You bring in a facilitator like me or like somebody else who can take that weight off of your shoulders and still get it done. Using a third party can be very helpful, so the HR person isn't the bad guy. I don't care if you hate me, April, at the end of the day, as long as you're getting the information that you need. I don't have to work there, right? I am gone at the end of the day or the end of the week. But, you know, it's the HR professional that you need to work with. So don't make the HR representative the bad guy. And you don't have to beat down the rules and the requirements every single day into folks until it feels overly burdensome, right? You just need, the HR professional needs to know that those rules exist. The employees need to know that they exist, because again, that allows the employees to feel more safe and comfortable in their workspace. You know what? We've got a 40-page manual about sexual harassment. Have I read it all? No. But I know that it exists. So if there is an issue, not only do I know that there are rules in place, but I know that there is somebody in HR who is going to listen to me and take my concerns seriously. That's what people want. Right. So it doesn't mean that you have to, you know, that everybody's got to walk around with this heavy burden on their shoulders at the same time. So the HR rep can do casual Fridays or Taco Tuesdays or whatever you want to do to build morale and camaraderie within the company without always beating down with, you know, these are the rules and so on and so forth. Just make sure the folks are aware that they exist. Make sure that there are, regular, and that may mean annual, that may mean semi-annual training, especially because if you've got some turnover, there are going to be people every year who haven't had the training before, and a refresher is good for everyone as well. Make sure the trainings are happening, but it's not like, you know, you have to walk around with, you know, the shame bell, to ensure that, you know, that the folks are doing everything that they're supposed to be doing all the time.
Got it. So we keep talking about diversity and inclusion. And I've been thinking about this a lot because being in the tech space, all startups are always talking about culture. Culture from day one. What is our mm-hmm. culture? Facebook's culture for a long time was move fast, break things, figure it out later. People are constantly focused on their culture, especially in our space. So with people looking to create such a strong culture from the very beginning, I'm always wondering, is it possible to create a culture that's inclusive for everyone? And what I mean by that is, should you opt out of a culture, or if you're a candidate or a potential employee somewhere, is it possible for you to see a company where the culture isn't bad, it's just not for you? Or does that inherently make it bad? Because you don't feel like you could thrive or be included in that. Does that make sense? Do you get what I'm saying?
I think so. Let me see if I respond, and if you don't like it, I'll try.
Sure.
I really think that it's crucial that potential hires, potential new employees, take culture into consideration. Now, there is a difference. I practiced law for nearly 20 years. So if you do the math, you know approximately how old I am.
Approximately.
And the culture, right. And the culture has changed significantly, in the last 20 years. And so when I was coming out, you know, you picked one job and you hoped that you were at that job for the rest of your life,
yep.
right? And that
yep.
that job sustained you in various ways. Now, you know, I see folks, you know, saying to me, I need to be at this particular gig for 18 months. I can get it on my resume and get the training, you know, and get the stuff that I need. And then I'm moving on. Like, they've already decided 18 months and out, which is fine. But what that also means is then you have to decide how important culture is to you for that 18 months. Right. And if the culture and the salary, hello, were exactly what you want it to be, would you stay for longer than 18 months? So I think culture is important, but perhaps it's not as important as it was because people are already, another hip hop reference, looking at the front door, right? They already know that this is not going to be their one and done job. However, I still think culture is incredibly important because 18 months can be a long time if you absolutely hate where you are. And if the market changes, so even if your plan is to leave after 18 months, if the economy, if the market, if whatever's going on in your personal life, financially and otherwise, say that you can't leave right now, that you have to stay for longer, you know, so does that mean that you hate your job because of the culture? Because, you know, you can do your job well, but it's a horrible place in which to do it. So I think, part of it is the HR rep's responsibility to foster an inclusive culture. But I also think that potential employees have the ability to shift, you know, that culture. So, you know, so if you get the offer and you say, you know what, this would be a great job and I could kill it for you, but I've decided not to go with you because of your corporate culture, that is going to stick in the mind of the interviewer. And hopefully they will take that back to the HR rep or whomever so that maybe that can be looked into if not changed. Because if you see a whole bunch of very qualified candidates saying, you know, the corporate culture sucks, or if you are doing, you know, anonymous surveys and your current employees are saying that, then you know it's time to make some changes.
Nice. You definitely killed that answer. So that was exactly what I was looking for. So I now want to tie in your internationally famous hashtag #OscarSoWhite into HR. And I was thinking for a while the best way to tie this into HR. And I wanted to ask you, since I'm assuming you've got a lot of attention around this, and when you look at what the workplace looks like in real life, and then you look at how the workplace is portrayed on television, in film, and I guess through any other medium, do you think the Oscars So White actually ties into that? And do you think that it's negatively portraying what a workplace should look like? Do you think TV and real life are kind of bouncing off of each other, so we can't really tell the difference? How do you see that?
Ooh, okay, that might be the hardest question so far. I definitely think, I mean, the issue behind Oscar So White, for anybody that might know, is the lack of diversity and inclusion in the entertainment space. So in January 2015, when I created the hashtag, you know, I was looking at the nominees, both for those in front of the camera, you know, best actor and actress and supporting, but also those behind the camera, because that's important too. Best director, best film, best editor, best cinematographer. And they were all a very homogenous, lead white group, right? And so there's an HR issue there as well, because again, we're talking about, and that's why issues of diversity and inclusion are pervasive across all industries,
right?
Because it's an issue with respect to the decision makers for those studios and networks, just as it is for those who run tech companies, you know, who run hospitals and every other industry. So what do the decision makers look like? What are the frames of reference that the decision makers are using when they cast actors and actresses, but also those behind the camera? So the example that I always use is Godfather 1 and Godfather 2. We do not speak of Godfather 3. but Godfather 1 and 2 were, you know, amazing films, right? They were tour de forces. They're my top five movies of all time, right? They were directed by Francis Ford Coppola, an Italian-American man who, you know, used his frame of reference as an Italian-American to really speak love onto the screen for those two films, right? And so you can really feel the Italian-American culture there. And you know, I think it was pervasive throughout the film. Beautiful film. You take out Francis Ford Coppola as director, and you insert Michael Bay, right? Also a white man, but not an Italian-American. And the movies completely change, right? Everything is blowing up, right? Yep, and it's a different film. And so that's why frames of reference matter. And it's also, you know, studios and networks say, oh, well, you know, we can't find, you know, Disney famously said last year or earlier this year, you know, there are a billion Asian and Asian American people on the planet, but we can't find Chu to play Jasmine and Aladdin for our live action film.
Right.
Really? So that, you know, that is, that's malarkey, you know, and I'm putting that mildly. But that speaks to their implicit bias. That speaks to their frames of reference. And so who makes the decisions, you know, who that studio head is that says, you know, we're doing this film called The Martian, and it's about a guy who, you know, gets stranded on Mars and he has to get himself back home somehow, and he ends up making potatoes from his own feces, whatever, whatever, right? There's nothing in that film, when it was pitched or otherwise, that says that that has to be a white man, that has to be Matt Damon, that even has to be a man. So then let's talk about it. Was Don Cheadle auditioned for that? Did Benicio Del Toro's agent get a call, you know, so that he could come in for that? So when you're making these decisions where race is not an integral factor to whom the character is, why aren't you, you know, studio head, being more inclusive? Why aren't you thinking outside the box and interviewing and auditioning folks from traditionally underrepresented communities. So the same issues apply. Who makes the decisions at the top? Who, maybe not at the top, but you can find who is acting as an ambassador on your behalf? And what implicit biases are sort of permeating all of the decision-making processes that perhaps you can exploit to your own benefit?
Nice. So in the same vein, I don't know if you've ever seen the show Silicon Valley, but yeah. I watch it. I think it's pretty hilarious. But it is very, I mean, you could tell as soon as you watch the first episode that there are hardly any Black characters. I think the only Black character in the show was a female stripper, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I was even struggling with was that as the show progressed in season one, season two, there were a lot of people on Twitter and Facebook and everywhere else saying they were pissed off. What the hell is this? Why does the show not have any Black characters? And people were fighting back saying, well, that's because they're making fun of real life. And in real life, there are hardly any Black people in Silicon Valley, which is true. So my question to you is, in the same vein of Oscar So White, forget a role where it could be Black, the person could be Black or Asian or Indian or Spanish descent, like in The Martian, where there was no predefined ethnicity or gender or type of person, for that matter, for that role. But when someone is not necessarily telling a period piece, but they're making fun of or describing something that's real life, should shows like that take a more progressive approach and say, yeah, we know how it is today, but this is how it could look and look how much better it would be if it was more diverse? Or because they're being true to life, is that okay?
But are they, though? Are they being true to life? Or is it a cop-out? Right, and I have had these conversations about various shows through the years. You know, I co-created the No Confederate hashtag because, you know, for part of this reason. But if you look at a show like, you know, I can't speak to Silicon Valley, but I know that there are Black people in tech, right, or people of color in tech, and I know that they are struggling mightily so that they can be seen. So why wouldn't you make that? And so again, this goes back to who are the writers? Who are the showrunners? Who are the directors who say, yes, the script is cool, and once again, we don't have any people from marginalized communities? You know, where are the women? You know, let's talk about that. You know, even if they're white women, you know, they are also a marginalized community in the tech industry. So why are they more prominently featured? You know, why, how can you have a show like Girls on HBO for years and there not be any people of color in the Republic of Brooklyn? Like, that, you know, no, what I mean? And I'm not even talking, you know, and I'm not even talking about the stars or the leads, but there aren't any, you know, there are no Dominicans on the street in Brooklyn. Come
right,
on now.
Right.
Like, you know, there are no, there, where are the Puerto Ricans just hanging out at the bodega as she goes in to get her condoms or whatever it is she's doing?
Kind of hard to go to Brooklyn and not see a bodega.
Impossible.
Right. Impossible.
Right? So, you know, and again, it doesn't have to be a main or lead character, but let's make sure that we are portraying real life accurately. You know, same thing with Friends way back in the day, which in truth was a white living single, excuse me. But even at Central Park, you know, the little coffee shop where they hung out, you know, there weren't even Gunther, you know, was a white dude. Like, there weren't, you know what I mean? There weren't even any people of color, you know, in service
right,
position.
Right, not even a bartender.
Listen,
right.
I mean, the right. Monkey, Marcel the Monkey got a recurring role before Aisha Tyler did as Ross's love interest, right? That doesn't make any sense. So that's fact. Look it up. So why can't you just reflect what reality is? You know, it's a cop out to say, you know, and again, I've had these arguments because I'm in the entertainment space. You know, oh, okay. Remember when John Boyega was announced to be joining Star Wars as a stormtrooper? And there were all kinds of bigots and discriminatory people who said, oh my God, we can't possibly have a black stormtrooper. It's against the canon and yada, 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 and this is a totally different genre. Now, we're talking science fiction, and I want you to,
right.
I want you to focus on that second word for a second, you know? Fiction.
Yeah, I get you. Fiction.
Right.
Fiction.
So how,
I got it.
So you can believe in Jar Jar Binks, but you can't believe in a black stormtrooper. Really? Is that where we are? So if you have creative, so the whole point of all of this is if you have creative license, why not make your show as inclusive or at least reflecting reality as you can? Because again, that's going to draw in viewers from different demographics that you may not have had otherwise. And that will lead to increased ratings. Again, it's about the bottom line, right? It's about money. If the more diverse your cast is, the more, and we've seen this in films for sure. Look at Fast and Furious 7, right? Nobody thinks about that as a multicultural film.
I know.
But it's the most multicultural, right? And how many, they're filming Fast and Furious 47 at this point, right?
Right. But they're all making ridiculous amounts of money.
Yes. And people will go see them and don't think about the fact that, you know, The Rock is Samoan and they've got a woman who's a driver and Tyrese, although, you know, RIP to his career, you know, that it was incredibly diverse cast, you know, but nobody really thinks about it. It's just a whole bunch of cars blowing up and it's funny and people go see it. So those are the same kinds of things that we see, bringing it back to our HR professionals that are listening. It all comes back to money. It all comes back to, you know, if you make something, whatever your genre or your sphere of influence is, the more diverse and inclusive that you make it, the more welcoming it will be to audience members, to potential employees, and the better morale that you will have at your particular company. So it's completely related. I mean, the entertainment industry is really no different in that sense than any other industry.
Oh, this is awesome. This is great. So before we go into our last section, are there any last words that you would like to part on our HR professionals who are hungry for this type of information and want to make sure that not only can they make their workplaces more diverse and inclusive, but that they actually know what that looks like once it happens?
I mean, hire people to help you as consultants. You know, whether it's me or someone else, you shouldn't have to be doing this alone. And very often, it's easier, as I said, for a third person to come in and say, you guys have got to do better, and so let's talk about best practices, and let me, you know, shake the table a little bit, as the kids are saying these days, and make some structural changes, and then work hand in hand with the HR professional to make sure that those things are implemented, right? And as I said, you know, one of the things that I build in is I'm coming back. You know, so it's one thing for you to say, yes, we want this training, we want the world to be a better place, yada, yada, yada. But if I come back in 3 months or 6 months and you haven't implemented those changes, then I know that you weren't serious. And then we have to figure out where the problem is. Is it that the HR professional is overwhelmed and couldn't implement those things? Is it that the HR professional tried and got pushback from, you know, the C-suite? Where is the problem? That in 6 months' time you haven't made this a more inclusive place, you know, or at least attempted to. So, you know, hire somebody, find yourself an ambassador. You know, again, that transcends all levels of the company. So HR professionals should also have an ambassador, like a VP or a P or something, where, you know, you've got somebody who will stand with you and say, yes, you know, what Jennifer is saying is a great idea. Let's go ahead and put this into practice. And then make sure you are always learning. Make sure that you have, you know, a budget for you to attend these trainings and conferences and workshops and so on, so that you are staying current, you know, so that you're not caught out there asking, you know, how quickly can we change the pronouns, you know, or whatever, you know, or change somebody's email address, right?
Yep.
How quickly can we make those changes because someone is going through transition or whatever the case may be, and so you're not caught flat-footed.
There's going to be a lot of rewinding of this podcast because you've been dropping a lot of gems and you've been dropping so many that I'm sure they can't even take notes fast enough.
And I talk really fast. Sorry about all that.
That's fine. So now let's go to our last section which is one of my favorites, which is called The Real, The Random, and The Ridiculous, where I ask you a real question, a random question, and a ridiculous question.
Okay.
You ready?
I think so.
All right. So, the real question, do you like bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made?
I am not a fan. I'm sorry. But I think that's because that I haven't been properly introduced to it. I do know, however, that I am not a fan of raisins. So if anybody wants to take me out for bread pudding and show me how I've been living my entire life wrong, I am open to it as long as there are no raisins involved. How's that?
I am going to have to bring you some bread pudding.
I'm here for it. I'm open.
You let me know where you are, and I will. My heart.
What makes bread pudding fantastic? Why are you so enthusiastic about it?
So why am I a bread pudding connoisseur?
Yeah. Oh,
well,
okay.
Because it can be made in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. The texture of the bread, where it's not a soupy pudding. I mean, I guess you could make it in a more liquidy form, but how moist it is and how soft, and the way you can eat it with the whipped cream and the sauce. And sometimes it can be made like French toast bread pudding, and then other times you can use brioche. I mean, there's so many different types of bread. So imagine all the types of bread just turned into
how is that better than a cinnamon bun?
Oh, man. like a cinnamon bun.
All right. I'm just saying, it's also bread with frosting.
Okay.
Again, I may not have been properly indoctrinated. I know my husband is a big fan of bread pudding. It's just never been my thing, but I am not opposed to having my mind blown.
Well, at least you married someone who has...
who has taste, right?
who has great food taste.
Indeed.
Right. Okay, so the random question. What's your favorite and least favorite thing about Twitter?
My favorite thing is that it has become my... See, you should have switched these because this is definitely the real question for me. My favorite thing is that it has become my community. It has become my tribe. I have, as I said, I have obtained jobs, plural, from Twitter. And from the use of my platform, I have helped other people get jobs because of Twitter, which is amazing, and so I love that, using my rainy day jobs hashtag. And it is the place that I go to hang out, and I have made lifelong friends in real life based on conversations and friendships that started on social media. The worst thing is the harassment that people with high profiles and platforms receive, especially women of color, because they deign to speak their minds on particular issues. Not necessarily even saying anything that was incredibly incendiary, but just existing, and watching, and attempting to assist them when they are ganged up on by folks who live in their mother's basement and sleep on musty futons, So that's the negative part, but I think the positive far outweighs the negative, at least for me. But I've also seen, some very prominent, amazing minds run off of Twitter, unfortunately, and other social media, because the harassment got to be too much. And so I'm hoping that they do better, that Twitter does better in addressing those issues.
I really respect people like yourself who have made a name for yourself and been able to monetize your brand off of Twitter. I am not a personal Twitter, Facebook, social media person. I can't wrap my head around it. From a business professional outreach, getting people on the podcast, sales, marketing channel, from a B2B standpoint.
Let's have another episode on that, because you are literally losing money by not taking advantage of the platform.
Yeah, we should. But from a personal brand standpoint, it's just too many people for me just saying things like, oh, I had French toast this morning, and then too many people liking it and commenting on it. But I know that just all depends on who you're following as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, the ridiculous question. I'm sure you're very aware that recently a black woman who worked at Apple, I think you may have heard of that company, said that diversity can be found all different types of ways. Doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be diversity by ethnicity. And it seems as though she believed that by having a group of 6 or 8 or 10 white men from different backgrounds or geographic locations, that that also could be diversity. So I'm going to ask you, I think I already know your answer, but I'm going to ask you, is that ridiculous? And if so, why?
Oh, well, it's ridiculous. And she didn't even last a year in the role. So clearly there weren't enough people at Apple to agree with her on that because she's on her way out the door. And I mean, I think that diversity and inclusion issues are incredibly important and they are vital to the success of an organization. And for her to minimize these issues in that way by not lifting up fellow women, hello, you are a woman, you know, fellow people of color, hello, you are a woman of color, you know, lifting up other traditionally underrepresented communities. That's why I use those words specifically, traditionally underrepresented communities, marginalized communities, right? That is where diversity and inclusion needs to focus. White folks, regardless of, you know, whether they have brown hair or blonde hair, you know, or their ancestry is German or Irish or Italian, they're not having any trouble here in America right now with respect to getting and retaining jobs, right? People from traditionally underrepresented communities are. And it is their insight that should be valued in corporations and organizations. And so that is where the focus should be. And I think it was unfortunate what she said, but I also think that it speaks to the fact that, you know, not everybody that calls themselves an expert on diversity and inclusion really is. You know, and so again, and this goes back to my Omarosa and Ben Carson moment, you know, from earlier in the podcast, right? Just having a black face or a brown face or a female in a particular role doesn't necessarily mean that you are doing the best thing for your company.
Well, you heard it first. You heard it first here on the podcast. April, thank you so much for being the most awesome, the most inspiring, and just for being an awesome, amazing person on the podcast, dropping so many gems, letting people know how they should go about diversity and inclusion, and the things that they should just do in life in general, just to make this a more diverse and inclusive place. So for that, I want to say thank you on behalf of everyone who's listening.
Thank you.
Hey, bro.
It's been fun.
Oh, had so much fun. So where can people find you on the internet?
Sure. So my all of my handles on various social media are Reign of April. So it's my name. It's a play on my name. So it's REIGNOF and then April, like the month. And that Twitter is my home. But I also have, you know, Facebook and LinkedIn. My website is reignofapril.com. So if you're looking for me, Reign of April is the place to go.
Well, thank you. And we'll definitely put that and everything else you reference in the show notes. So HR folks, we've done it again. We've had an amazing podcast. Just to remind you that if you are looking for a great and user-friendly HR dashboard, so you can see all your high-level metrics about diversity and recruiting and tenure, retention, and all those other things that you care about, you can definitely go to employeecycle.com to get a free demo. If you love this episode, and more importantly, if you enjoyed everything that April had to say, which I'm sure you did, please give us a 5-star rating for this episode on iTunes and download us on whatever podcast player you're using on your phone. And remember, HR folks, continue to hire, train, and retain the best people at your company possible. Thanks. Later, kids.